is able to circumvent a lot of scrutiny by arguing that they have a law enforcement national security basis for using it. So you now have a perfect storm, Amy, of technology of this type that's really powerful and really easily abused in the hands of the U.S. government, again, under the Biden administration. The Biden administration has, in response to reporting on this just recently, paused that contract. They say they're reviewing it. But the thing is, right around the corner, the Trump administration is coming in, and we can talk about this, but obviously the Trump administration is bringing in a raft of officials, and Trump himself, who have made explicit threats against the groups that, again and again, in Western democracies, have been most vulnerable to this kind of espionage.
That's Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ronan Farrow and Matthew O'Neill talking about their new documentary, Surveil, that airs tonight at 9 on HBO, is streaming at Max. We'll link to Ronan's New Yorker article, The Technology the Trump Administration Could Use to Hack Your Phone. We'll talk more about that with him tomorrow. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
You're listening to KBOO's Catalog of Connections year-end campaign, where we bring you a range of community-oriented programming built by community members like you. Help KBOO reach our $75,000 goal by December 31st, so we can bring you another great year of cutting-edge radio made by you for you. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321 to contribute today.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, people who get SNAP benefits have until December 18th to claim replacement benefits.
The Supreme Court hears arguments against a law that would prevent transgender people from accessing health care.
And the top 12 U.S. billionaires just got even richer.
Good evening. This is KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, December 4th, 2024. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Hannah Francis.
And I'm Eliza Yurkov. Households in certain Oregon counties who lost food due to power outages during recent storms have 30 days to apply for recent SNAP benefits. Anyone who bought food with Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, SNAP funds, can request replacement benefits for the cost of the lost food. SNAP is a federal program that provides food assistance to low-income families and individuals in Oregon. The storm that hit November 19th and 20th, widely known as the bomb cyclone, had strong winds and heavy rainfall that caused power outages for more than 25,000 households in Oregon. Normally, and in the counties not included in this exemption, applicants have 10 days to apply for loss of food replacement benefits. The 22 included counties have an extended 30 days until December 18th. The counties offering this extended period for replacement benefits are Benton, Clackamas, Clatsop, Coos, Deschutes, Douglas, Jackson, Jefferson, Josephine, Klamath, Lake, Lane, Lincoln, Lynn, Mollier, Marion, Multnomah, Polk, Tillamook, Umatilla, Washington, and Yamhill counties. There are three ways to request replacement SNAP benefits. Recipients may call 800-699-9075. They can fill out a request form at the Oregon Department of Human Services website and email it to oregon.benefits@odhsoha.gov, or they can visit a local ODHS office.
The Supreme Court heard arguments in the case U.S. versus Scrimeti today. It challenges a Tennessee law that denies transition care to transgender youth. The plaintiffs, three trans youth and their parents, argue that the law violates the Equal Protection Clauses of the 14th Amendment because of its sex-based discrimination. U.S. Solicitor General Elizabeth Preligar said, quote, "The law restricts medical care only when provided to induce physical effects inconsistent with birth sex. Someone assigned female at birth can't receive medication to live as a male, but someone assigned male can," end quote. Chief Justice John Roberts, favoring the law, said, quote, "The Constitution leaves that question to the people's representatives rather than to nine people, none of whom is a doctor," end quote. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson said leaving the question to the states was an alarming abdication of responsibility. Quote, "I'm suddenly quite worried," she said. More than 20 other states have similar laws that this decision could affect. The Supreme Court will publish their decision in June.
The top 12 U.S. billionaires now control over $2 trillion. That's double what the top 12 billionaires controlled just 4 years ago in 2020. This is the greatest amount of wealth concentrated in the United States history. Omar Ocampo is the author of the Institute for Policy Studies report on the billionaires. Ocampo said, quote, "The oligarchic dozen is richer than ever, and they are endowed with extreme material power that can be used to pursue narrow political interests at the expense of the Democratic majorities," end quote. According to Ocampo, each of the billionaires on the list, quote, "owns or is a controlling shareholder of a business that is investing billions of dollars in artificial intelligence," end quote. The newest member to the list is Jensen Huang, the co-founder and CEO of NVIDIA. Intel's drop in value and relevance launched NVIDIA, a fellow semiconductor chip manufacturer, through the stock market as it reached the most valuable publicly traded company this year.
Oregon's homicide rate has surged by 172% in the past decade. A new report finds almost three-quarters of guns used in these crimes are illegally trafficked or stolen from legal gun dealers. It recommends more frequent inspections, safety regulations, and employee training to curb the flow of gun trafficking. Isabel Charlet reports.
Nearly 40% of guns used in Oregon homicides are illegally trafficked through legal gun dealers, and another 30% are stolen from them, according to new research. The report by the Alliance for a Safe Oregon highlights gaps in security, training, and inspections among the state's 2,100 gun dealers. The report says employees often lack training to detect straw purchases when someone buys a gun for another person who can't legally own one. Jess Marks with the Alliance says increasing state inspections, which now happen only every 10 years, could help reduce illegal gun trafficking.
When we compare that to every other industry, hair salons, nail, taco trucks, the cannabis industry that are inspected every 6 months, every 2 years, we have got to be doing better.
The report says training employees to recognize straw gun sales, as well as upgrading gun dealers' storage and security measures, goes a long way. Mark says states with these policies in place, like New Jersey, have a 35% lower homicide rate. The report says straw purchases and stolen firearms have fueled a significant rise in Oregon homicides, which have surged by 172% in the past decade. Marks emphasizes that most gun dealers are unaware when fraudulent purchases occur. She says more regulations would protect ethical dealers.
The vast majority who are good dealers, they don't want other dealers allowing firearms going into and showing up in crimes.
The report blames lax oversight that allows Oregon gun dealers with repeated safety and security violations to operate without repercussions. Mark says the solutions are common sense policies that most people support.
And if we want to bring down our homicide rate, lower shootings, we've got to deal with the problem of illegal guns in our communities.
I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The holiday season is often seen as a time of joy and celebration, but for Oregonians mourning the loss of a loved one, it can be a deeply painful reminder of who's missing. So how do you cope when everyone is celebrating, but you're struggling? It's Isabel Charlet again, sharing tips on how to deal with holiday grief.
'Tis the season for celebration and good cheer. However, for many Oregonians, the absence of a loved one, whether through death, divorce, or another painful separation, can make this time of year feel almost unbearable. According to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, 64% of people with depression report the holidays just make them feel worse. Oncology and palliative care social worker Noah Curtis says it's important to be honest about your feelings.
Allow yourself to be angry or sad or lonely. It's also okay to feel a sense of joy or connection if that comes up too. Avoid places where you feel pressure to put on a happy face or bottle up your emotions.
If you or someone you know is struggling with a mental health crisis, help is available 24/7. Call or text 988, the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline, to connect with someone for free and confidential support. While many enjoy Oregon's dynamic climate, the state's long winters and reduced daylight can also worsen depression, especially for those with seasonal affective disorder, the aptly named SAD. Curtis advises sharing emotions with trusted friends and family and reflecting on happy memories of loved ones.
You can look for small moments of comfort, embrace traditions that you once shared, you can set a place for them at the table. It's okay to ignore the holidays too, but just honoring the love and connection that is still present.
Mental health professionals also emphasize that while family traditions can provide comfort and remembrance, it's okay to let go if they become too painful. Explore new ways to celebrate, and over time, new traditions will naturally evolve. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
GOP senators voice reservations about Kash Patel, Trump's FBI pick. President Biden continues to face scrutiny over pardoning his son, and GOP House members gear up for tough budget fights, possibly targeting important programs. With more on the story, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Kash Patel understands the problems with the FBI, and he is a reformer that will not be captured by the bureaucrats.
Florida Republican Governor Ron DeSantis supports Kash Patel, President-elect Donald Trump's pick to run the FBI. But some GOP moderates in the closely divided Senate are voicing doubts about the controversial pick's promise to purge the agency and close its headquarters. After resisting, the Trump transition is now agreeing to let the Justice Department vet nominees. Illinois Democratic Congressman Sean Casten has made a long-shot move to force the House Ethics Committee to release its report on former Florida Representative Matt Gaetz. Casten says the committee is undermining its own credibility by not putting out its findings about the failed attorney general nominee.
And impedes the safety, dignity, and integrity of the legislative proceedings of the House.
A close friend of the Biden family, Delaware Democratic Senator Chris Coons, says he understands President Joe Biden's pardon of his son, Hunter, given threats of retribution. But Coons says he fears it could make it harder to criticize Trump's future pardons.
I am concerned about what's going to happen to the scope of the pardon power going forward.
House Republicans are calling on Democrats to prepare for tough budget decisions and possibly cuts to popular programs. Georgia Congressman Rich McCormick says they want to look at Social Security and Medicare.
We're going to have some hard decisions. We got to bring the Democrats in and talk about Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare.
Trump critic and former Congressman Adam Kinzinger says he isn't afraid of the new administration, but adds democracy will be put to the test starting in January.
America someday is going to have to wake up, and they will wake up and say, my goodness, we've got to protect this. This is too precious to let flounder.
U.S. officials say they're relieved South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol is withdrawing a declaration of martial law. He accused the liberal opposition of criminal anti-state acts on behalf of the communist North. But protests against a possible return to dictatorship were immediate and intense. Vedant Patel is a State Department deputy spokesperson.
Our hope is that any political disputes will be resolved peacefully and in accordance with the rule of law.
Advocates are calling on Biden to take executive action to protect immigrant communities ahead of possible Trump mass deportations. Nevada Democratic Senator Catherine Cortez Masto says Biden could take DACA and temporary protected status migrants out of the undocumented category, giving them a level of certainty and protection.
What I take is what I hear from this incoming administration. They're going to engage in mass deportation and nobody's safe.
I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You're listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $75,000 by December 31st. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any point during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Kay Rambo, the editor-in-chief at Street Roots. Their newest article examines the health panels that control care in Oregon prisons and how they often delay or deny needed treatment. At 6, it's Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. At 7, it's The Global Sale. Tonight's weather will be clear and cold with a low of 34 degrees. And tomorrow it will be cold and cloudy with a high of 45 degrees. Today in history, Fred Hampton, deputy chairman of the Black Panther Party and founder of the Rainbow Coalition, was assassinated during an FBI raid in Chicago in 1969. His death caused public outrage and disintegrated the public's opinion of the FBI and instigated widespread government distrust. The quote of the day is from the prolific revolutionary. Hampton was a prodigy for mobilizing communities and made dozens of quote-worthy speeches. In one of them, he said, quote, "We've got to face the fact that some people say you fight fire best with fire, but we say you put fire out best with water. We say you don't fight racism with racism. We're going to fight racism with solidarity."
Crews in Winnipeg, Canada, are searching a landfill for two Indigenous victims of a serial killer. With that story and more, it's Brian Bull with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. A grim search is underway at a landfill site near Winnipeg for the remains of two murdered Indigenous women. This is the fourth stage of a five-stage plan that is expected to continue until the spring. More from Dan Carpentchuk.
Wab Kanu, the province's first Indigenous premier, was on hand for the start of the work, as teams began the huge task of sifting through nearly 8,000 square feet of waste. They're looking for the remains of Morgan Harris and Mercedes Myron. Jeremy Skibitsky was convicted of killing them and two other Indigenous women, Rebecca Contois, whose remains were found in a different landfill, and a woman identified only as Buffalo Woman. Premier Wab Kanu was with the Myron and Harris families as the work began.
This morning, I was there with two family members as we watched that first blue truck of landfill material come down to the search facility. And it is an intense emotion.
It was 2 years ago that the families found out that the two girls had been murdered by Skibitsky. Tons of material have already been excavated to bring the search to the approximate time the bodies would have been left there. Amna Mackin leads the project.
As we start to find items of interest, such as receipts or papers that have dates and addresses, we'll be continually looking at that information to see what it's telling us and whether or not we're in the right location of interest.
There are about 45 people in the search team, which includes family members, a forensic anthropologist, a health and safety officer, and a director of operations. The search of the landfill will continue 6 days a week for the next several months. Premier Kanu says he prays to God that the search will succeed. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
After nearly 70 years of work, fishery managers say lake trout have fully recovered in most of Lake Superior, a development that's sure to please regional Native American tribes. As Danielle Kading reports, that comes after a fish-killing invader decimated the trout's numbers.
The lake trout population dropped dramatically during the mid-1900s due to overfishing and an invasion of sea lampreys. The eel-like parasitic fish feeds on the blood of lake trout. It spread to Lake Superior by 1938. At that time, the commercial harvest of the lake's top predator was 4 million pounds, but that dropped 95% by the mid-1960s. Bill Mattis chairs the Lake Superior Committee of the Great Lakes Fishery Commission.
What we're seeing in our assessments are that the numbers of fish in the lake are similar to that seen in the lake prior to lamprey invasion and overharvest.
Mattis is also with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. Lake Superior tribes use gill nets to commercially harvest fish, and he says the assessments show they can be used to sustainably catch fish.
We've done a really good job of harvest management and of controlling those harvests over time.
Mattis says those efforts, along with lamprey controls, has helped create a self-sustaining population. For National Native News, I'm Danielle Kading.
And a people's celebration for the removal of four hydroelectric dams on the Klamath River takes place Saturday in California's Arcata Theater Lounge. Regina Chikizola is with the group Save California Salmon. She says previous events featured politicians and tribal councilors.
What we want to do with this celebration is celebrate all the people and organizers and families. So we have a lot of elders coming out, and then we're going to have a few bands play. All three of the bands are part of communities that helped fight for dam removal.
The removal of the dams followed decades of lobbying by Native Americans and allies who say salmon are already back to their traditional spawning grounds.
It's time to celebrate, and it's time to bring our kids up there to see the salmon spawning and just let the world know that you can win these really big fights even when it seems impossible, especially if people listen to the guidance of the Native communities that have knowledge on how to get it done.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios of Eugene, Oregon.
Preliminary data shows that 127 people in Multnomah County used deflection services since the state recriminalized drugs on September 1st. The program redirects or deflects people into treatment instead of serving jail time for possession of small amounts of illegal drugs. The number of referrals by law enforcement fluctuates from week to week, but the county says there's been an overall increase in deflection. Multnomah County Behavioral Health Division Deputy Director Jen Gulzow said, quote, "We are still a ways away from seeing any trends or patterns in the numbers. It may be tempting to draw definitive conclusions about the program's early performance, but that would be premature. Like other new programs, we need to give the program time to work and conduct a thorough analysis of the data," end quote. Director Heather Mirasol seemed optimistic. She said, quote, "We've seen a lot of positive connections to services for those that we have served in the few months since the deflection program began. We're learning a lot. We continue to pivot and be flexible as we identify barriers for participants and as we work to streamline processes surrounding this innovative approach," end quote. The program began with the enactment of House Bill 4002, which reintroduced criminal penalties for people in Oregon caught possessing small amounts of illegal substances. The deflection program has been active since September 1st, but the Coordinated Care Pathway Center, or CCP, located on Southeast Sandy Boulevard, has only been open since mid-October. People have 30 days to complete the deflection process, and the care coordination team is responsible for following up with them. If people don't complete the deflection process, they aren't eligible to try again, even if they are re-arrested. Multnomah County is supposed to add sobering services to this deflection center next year. More detailed program outcomes, like the number of unsuccessful deflections and some demographic information, will be published in mid-February.
Opal, or Organizing People Activating Leaders, is an environmental justice organization focused on transportation initiatives like reducing transit fare. On November 12th, the board decided to lay off all 9 employees and to continue their work solely through volunteer programs. The board attributed their decision to financial challenges that stemmed from losing support from major funders. The group, founded in 2005, is most notable for its influence on Portland transit changes. In 2014, TriMet voted to extend transfer windows from 2 to 2.5 hours, thanks to Opal's Bus Riders Unite union. Bus Riders Unite pushed for a 3-hour window and argued any less time unfairly hurts low-income riders and people of color concentrated in areas with less frequent service. They also pushed for discounted fares, and in 2018, TriMet introduced an expanded Youth Pass and the Honored Citizens Pass. They have been pressing TriMet to drop fares altogether and promote alternatives to police for security on MAX trains and buses. The board of directors said in an Instagram post, quote, "These were hard and painful decisions to reduce Opal's operations, and we recognize the livelihoods of 9 hardworking staff and their families are deeply impacted. We offer a sincere apology to this team and the people of Oregon. We must do better. We will do better," end quote.
Portland City Council held what is likely to be its third-to-last regular Wednesday morning meeting today. The new 12-member council is set to be sworn in on Thursday, January 2nd. KBOO reporter Sam Bowman was at this morning's meeting and has this report.
Close to 100 people, including staff and media, were in the temporary council chambers at the start of this morning's 9:30 meeting. The city council has been meeting at the city's Development Services Center near the PSU campus, while City Hall is being renovated to accommodate the much larger new council. Commissioner Carmen Rubio was the only absence, though even she attended virtually for the first item on the agenda, which was also why the majority of the crowd had showed up, to celebrate and memorialize the life of longtime Portland conservation and wildlife advocate Bob Salinger. Salinger passed away suddenly on October 30th at the age of 57. He was currently the executive director of Willamette Riverkeeper and conservation director at the Bird Alliance of Oregon, and frequently met, collaborated, and argued with city staff, several of whom offered remembrances of Salinger today.
I'm Donnie Chiama, the director of the City of Portland's Bureau of Environmental Services. I had the great pleasure to know Bob for several decades, and I could always count on him to tell me what he really thought, and I also always knew where his tender heart was. His ideas, input, and partnership with environmental services didn't just lead to projects. It helped build a culture of conservation and a broader understanding of why conservation is important. A cornerstone of his legacy was his ability to connect with people. While we've lost a part of ourselves with his passing, please know that his spirit and legacy will live on in our work, and he will always be a part of our community and the environment he worked so tirelessly to protect.
Mayor Ted Wheeler read an official remembrance of Bob Salinger, and a short recess followed. Incidentally, KBOO's Locus Focus also has a Remembering Bob Salinger episode that came out this week. The meeting continued with a significantly smaller crowd. The communications segment at the beginning, when members of the public can read prepared statements on any topic, was dominated by a group of neighbors from the Northwest Stadium neighborhood who talked about open drug use and drug dealing they have observed in their neighborhood, as well as a harm reduction group that distributes supplies in the area and other mutual aid initiatives. This was met with unanimous sympathy from city council members, including Mayor Wheeler, who outlined recent changes in city policy in that area, including increased police presence and response to open use and increased cleanup services. Commissioner Rene Gonzalez also made a point of saying that the city has a, quote, entrenched enablement culture, which was met with nods from the other councilors. The longest item on the agenda was the approval of the North Portland in Motion Plan, a non-binding but well-supported plan to bolster pedestrian, bicycle, and transit needs in North Portland. The plan is based on 3 years of city outreach and planning with residents and organizations in the area and includes designating new greenways and bike routes, including a revamp of the crossing over I-5 at North Ainsworth. Here is Nick Coda with the Overlook Neighborhood Association.
Ainsworth's wide hot pavement and wide overpass over I-5 is abused every day by dangerous drivers who'd rather drive quickly and dangerously through North Portland, even past Ockley Green, middle school students, and beach students who have no other street to cross I-5. The project now proposes new crosswalks for students, improved lighting for long winter nights, bike lanes to separate folks on bikes where needed. It also extends North Portland's all-too-small tree canopy. Without any investment, Ainsworth acts as a barrier for our communities instead of a connector.
The plan passed with a 4-0 council vote. The meeting proceeded with some more technical agenda items, including approval of some amendments to the Montgomery Park area plan, which could see expanded streetcar service into deeper northwest Portland. The main vote on that plan will be held next week. The meeting's most dramatic moment was a vote on whether to allow the city attorney to file an unfair labor practice complaint against AFSCME Local 189, which represents many city workers. This would be for holding two of what the union called practice pickets, despite its contract with the city forbidding strikes or pickets by the union or lockouts by management. AFSCME held these events on October 9th outside the Portland Water Bureau and November 4th outside the Justice Center. It's not clear if they were on city property, and AFSCME maintains that they did not block or discourage people from entering the buildings. After each instance, the city filed a grievance with AFSCME alleging that the pickets breached their contract. Grievances are lesser complaints compared to unfair labor practice complaints, or ULPs, which involve the state's Labor Relations Board. The city and AFSCME have been in negotiations over their labor contract for 6 months, with little progress made. The current contract expires at the end of the year, including its prohibitions on strikes and lockouts. The city and the union have a meeting scheduled for tomorrow in order to hash out the grievances, and Deputy City Attorney Heidi Brown made clear she was only asking for permission to file a ULP if an understanding cannot be reached behind closed doors tomorrow. The city would have 180 days from the first incident on October 9th to file the ULP. Here is Heidi Brown talking with Mayor Wheeler.
Is there anything else?